At the time, this is a remarkable thing, isn't it, that people in this country were living in hill forts and so on. And if you can imagine a little family there, and imagine the kind of conversations, all very humdrum, you'd probably be thinking, well, all very nice, interesting, but what's that got to do with us? Well, at the time, these sorts of families on the hill forts in England were having their conversations. We have, in this country, another family. It seems almost an archetypal little Western family, man, wife, and two boys. And yet, this whole book of Ruth is about them and what happens. And it's very, very mundane and ordinary. The whole book, there's about 85 verses in Ruth, of which 50 are conversation. So it's a story that is told through conversation. And why is it here? And what can we learn from it? Those are the obvious things that come to the mind at this time. It is a time really of backsliding, of spiritual compromise and darkness. You see in verse 1, it's a time when the judges ruled. And if you just turn over your page and see the final verse of the book of Judges, you see this. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It's a time of anarchy and people just living as they pleased. And yet, in this dark, we would look at the society and say backward. It's not medieval, it's almost prehistorical. But in that, those dark, very, very distant days, here was a little family. And not so much here, but as that family moves on and Ruth stays with Naomi and then subsequently marries Boaz, you see the Lord at work. And you see in this chapter and the second chapter and subsequently, you see the workings of grace in individual lives. You see character in individual believers that stand out. And if there's any message at all, it isn't just about how an outsider is brought into the line of David, which is what it is, because you have Ruth who becomes marries Boaz and they have a son, Salmon, and then it feeds through into the line of David. So the Lord Jesus Christ is descended from this Moabites, ultimately Ruth. It isn't just about how a Gentile is brought in. It isn't just about how Boaz is descended from Rahab. It is really about the living uprightly and godly in dark days amongst ordinary people. Boaz was a wealthy man, he was a prominent and an eminent man, but he wasn't a military leader, he wasn't a king. He was still ordinary. And here you have the Lord working. Now I want to focus, well, just take this chapter as it stands really, and say that there are, in this chapter, we have 3 days. You look back on your life, if you ever kept a diary, and sometimes it's very routine, isn't it? You get up, you have your cornflakes, things you do every day, you get washed, have a shave, whatever, and everything just runs on a pattern. It's a typical Monday, it's a typical Wednesday, that kind of thing. It's difficult to know what to put in a diary. But then there are some days that just stand out. You wake up in the morning and you have no idea whatsoever what is going to unfold. Real significant turning point kind of days. And there are 3 such days in this chapter. And the first is the day that this little family, Elimelech, the man, Naomi, his wife, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, decide to leave. They come to that choice. There was a real famine, and they up and leave. It's ironical because Bethlehem means house of bread, and in the house of bread there's a famine. Now, I don't want to belittle the famine, but it doesn't seem to be a widespread kind of movement. It's just this family are upping and leaving. Did they have to go? Possibly not. Did they seek the Lord's face about what they should do? No sign that they did. Maybe the famine was the little trigger that perhaps kicked off something that had been simmering away in the mind for a while. They wanted a new start, maybe. And it might have been a bit awkward explaining that to the other folk in Bethlehem, but here they are, the economic migrants. They are going to forge a new life in the place called Moab, which is to the east of the Jordan. I think that's in the area of Syria now. Mountainous in the north, but some fertile plains to the south. And here there's fertility and they can make a new living. And so they leave. Well, as Naomi's testimony at the end in verse 21 is, they leave full of finances. They've got all their luggage with them, they've got wealth. Yeah, he's an eminent man. They're full of optimism, full of hopes, full of dreams, and they set out on that day. Maybe they explain to the folk in Bethlehem, well, it's just, you know, we're just a bit worried about the boys and a bit worried about this famine. It's just a temporary thing. But everything about their body language suggests it's a bit more than temporary. And off they go. And they remain there in the land of Moab. They settle down, in other words. That's the first day, a day full of hope and promise. I don't know what the other villagers thought. Perhaps there was a bit of smugness on the part of Elimelech and Naomi. I thought, well, we're all right. We're sorry about you, but we're just looking after ourselves. Elimelech means God is king. Naomi means pleasant, lovely, delightful. But everything about this little family said, actually, family is king with us. We're putting our family first. And we are going to make a lovely, delightful, pleasant new life for ourselves in Moab. And so they set off in that way. And as I say, they settle down. Now I know that it's in verse 6 that Naomi hears that the famine's over. I can't really believe that this is famine lasts anything like that length of time. You have at least 10 years, but more than that, because there's 10 years when, from the death of Elimelech, they stay there for a very, very long time. I don't know whether that's because Naomi's not really interested in what's happened. She hasn't picked up news. Maybe it is just difficult to get news. But if it was simply a desire to stay temporarily, go back next year when the harvest is over, well, it didn't happen, did it? And so as I say, I think there's a bit more to this than just wanting to escape the famine. And then there's the second day, and that is the day that Naomi sets out, the day that she comes to this conclusion that she has to go back. The temporary has already become long-term. We suspected that at the outset. That was realized. And the wheels have already come off the dream. They, bit by bit, all those hopes, they have just dissipated in the reality of everyday life. The harsh sadness, her husband dies. She's on her own. She stays. She has her two boys, Marlon and Killian. They marry, verse 4. And of course they marry pagan wives. Well, of course they do. How else are they going to... What else does Naomi expect? They made that decision when they went to Moab. The fact that they took Moabite wives should come as no surprise. The name of one is Orpah, the name of the other is Ruth. The decision is not so much about the daughters-in-law, it was the decision to leave the place that God's blessing was in the first place. How do you look on that kind of decision that they made to leave? Do you say, well, they walked out on the will of God? That there's God's way for them and there's their way, and they missed the path, and then they were always going to be outside of God's will until they found their way back onto it? Or is it more a case of God is still with them in this? There's an indication, I would suggest, that the famine in Bethlehem to start with is perhaps something of God's judgment. And also you can say that what's happening to Naomi, her stays in life, her supports, her hopes, everything that she's pinned her life on is taken from her. Elimelech dies, then the two boys die. She's left as the sole survivor out of that little family. Her husband and her two boys gone. She's nobody apart from these two daughters-in-law. And is it the case that this, her hold on life and her dreams, is as though God is unpicking the grip of her fingers one by one, so she's letting go. And so she comes to a point where she's at an end of herself. It's not so much that God is judging her and punishing her, but God is closing off these routes that she thought was the route to happiness, and God is saying, that isn't actually the way to happiness. That's a dead end. That's a cul-de-sac. Can't you see? You put your hope in a family. Well, the family is not permanent. Your hope should be in me. Now, that might sound hard if you were thinking of the husband and the two sons. Are they just taken so that Naomi can learn something from that? Well, these are difficult things, and you can't pry too deeply into that because you just don't know. But you have to leave this as it is and take it as it is. But here, Naomi's grip on life is being taken away. And so when she comes to verse 6, you have to say she's at an end of herself. She's picked up on the fact that God has visited his people in giving them bread. Now, sometimes you read in Scripture that God visits his people, and that can be in judgment. But here he's visited them in grace. He's provided for them. He has stepped in to help them. And she hears about that. And she's wistful. Maybe with each successive bereavement in the family, she's thought about, should she go back? She's weighed it up. And she's rejected it. But on this occasion, that resistance has gradually been whittled away. There's nothing left. And she decides she must go back. And so this is the second significant day in her life. She leaves. She She went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on their way. There is a substantial amount now of conversation of what takes place between Naomi and her two daughters-in-law. And she persuades them. And I wouldn't want to be critical on Orpah. It was asking a huge amount to think that they would accompany Naomi. Why should they? They've got their own family. They're not Israelites. They do, as Naomi said to them, you have a chance of finding a husband, making a life for yourself. There is the reference to the Naomi having other sons. That's what was called the levirate marriage, where if the oldest one dies, you'd marry the next son, and that was the basis of Henry VIII and his older brother, when he died, marrying Catherine of Aragon. In all the research that the scholars were put to at the time of the Reformation, that was the sort of issues they were wrestling with. Anyway, it's not really important for our purposes, only that Naomi is saying, I'm too old. I'm going back to my family, such as, or the people I was with, certainly. You stay here. And she persuades Orpah, and Orpah can see, yes, that is right. And then, of course, Ruth takes the completely different opposite line to her sister-in-law, Orpah. And where Orpah goes back, Ruth, verse 14, clings to Naomi. Naomi says, look, your sister-in-law's gone back. She's gone back to her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth says this beautiful statement of personal loyalty to Naomi, loyalty to Naomi's God. This is moving. And makes me think that perhaps what I've said about Elimelech and Naomi and abandoning Israel, I want to put some caveats around that, because Naomi hasn't abandoned the Lord. She's spoken about the Lord. Ruth knows that the Lord is Naomi's God. So I don't think we can say Naomi's walked out on God. She hasn't. I think she's just allowed her dreams, or Elimelech and Naomi have allowed their dreams to supersede it. But nonetheless, Ruth has heard from Naomi all about the God of Israel and Naomi's God, and she's drawn to him. And she says, I want him to be my God. Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. The Lord do so to me. Or also, if anything but death parts you and me. And you'll see in the New King James that anything, the word anything in verse 17 is in italics, which means it's been added on. So what she's really saying is, even death won't part us. I want to be buried in the same grave as you. I will stick with you. Now what's remarkable about this is Naomi is a different generation to her, a different people, but more than that, she is, on her own testimony, an embittered old lady. Her name was originally pleasant and delightful, but she, on her own confession, is anything but that now. She's looked at all that's happened to her and says, God has been against me. The hand of the Lord has gone out. And even what she's saying to her daughters-in-law, there's time for you. You can find life. Implicitly, she's saying, it's over for me. I'm at the end. There's nothing left for me but to go back. I don't want to burden you with my griefs. No, let's separate. And Ruth says, no, I'll cling to you. Even in her bitterness, your God will be my God. As I say, it's a remarkable thing for Ruth to say. But this is the second day as Naomi decides to leave, and does leave. And then there's the third day. And that's the day they arrive back in Bethlehem. Verse 18, when Naomi can see that Ruth is determined to go with her, she can't. She knows it would be inappropriate and wrong to try and persuade her. That statement that she's come out with is so powerful that she cannot contradict her and accept that Ruth is going to go with her. So the two of them arrive in Bethlehem. Now, I think we just need to try and put ourselves in Naomi's shoes here. It's many years since she went. She probably dreaded this, as you would. She'd walked out on the her fellow women. She'd left them. She'd said all that she'd said. And now she's coming back. Very different. Looked very different. Probably looked... may have gone out, she was full, may have gone out a bit plumpish, coming back very haggard and drawn, skinny maybe, very lined with worry, anxiety, how were they going to fare? May have gone very difficult for her in Moab, just surviving as a widow, very difficult, and dreading meeting these folk, as you would. Probably would have wished to creep in at the dead of night, find that somebody that you could call a friend and stay with them, lie low, gradually ease your way back into the community. Just the human thought of facing these folk again. But it's a worse nightmare. They arrive in verse 19... middle of the day, and all the city was excited because of them. I don't think that's necessarily a good excitement. They're not saying, oh, look, it's Naomi, great, she's back. I think there was a rather salacious and unpleasant, is this Naomi? Cool, look at this one. Look at the state of Naomi. Do you remember Naomi? All those years she went out so smug, so full of optimism and dreams. Look at her now. She went out. She had two boys and a husband. What's happened to them? And all the questions would come out. And poor Naomi. But credit to her. She is honest. She doesn't try and pretend that everything went well. She doesn't hide. She doesn't lie. She is straightforward, honest. And she says, don't call me Naomi. It's not pleasant, it's not lovely, it's not been delightful. Call me Mara, bitter, because the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. You see the bitterness there, don't you? Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me? And the Almighty has afflicted me. It's sad seeing folk that become embittered in old age, isn't it? There's nothing sweeter than an old person who loves the Lord and is a very sweet person. In some ways, perhaps, what they are in life gets exaggerated in old age. So if they're sweet, lovely in life, they become really sweet and lovely in old age. But those that are embittered, sometimes it becomes such a character trait that they're just incapable of anything else. And Naomi seems to be heading that way. And it's unpleasant to be around her. You'd feel that if you were in verse 21 with the folk listening on, you'd think, oh dear, I don't want to listen too much to this. But we'll see through this book that Naomi is transformed by the grace of God. And transformed as well by the goodness and loyalty of Ruth. And you find her at the end with a grandchild on her knee and the people delighting in her. It's a wonderful, lovely, homely tale. Now, in all of this, we haven't read anything about God other than in conversation. But God has been in this. God has led these folk. God has led them away, brought them back. God is dealing with her. And right at the end, verse 22, Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess. The writer doesn't let us forget that Ruth's a foreigner. And they came back from the country of Moab, and they come to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. Just a little clue in that final verse, it's the beginning of barley harvest. Something is going to happen here. It's all very ordinary, it's all very mundane, but God works not just at the high level, but he works in ordinary lives, and he brings his purposes to pass. I trust there is something there in the way in which God fashions and shapes ordinary lives and shapes character that makes us, encourages us to trust him and to enjoy him in life and live the day, the mundane day, to his glory and find loyalty to him, a supreme quality. Well, may the Lord encourage us and bless us for his name's sake. Amen. Singing.